University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Fred Ormond, professor of clarinet at the University of Michigan School of Music, and his lecture, Clarinet Alone. Ormond was appointed to the faculty at the University of Michigan in 1984 and has served on the faculty of the Music Academy of the West, Santa Barbara, California, since 1989. An active performer of chamber, contemporary, and orchestral music, he has toured extensively as a founding member of the Interlochen Arts Quintet and the Dusha Quartet. In 1988, Ormond was a visiting professor at the Shanghai Conservatory of Music and soloist with the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra, and served as soloist for the new Portuguese Philharmonia's tour of northern Portugal. Ormond has also toured with the Chicago Little Symphony and the Hong Kong Philharmonic, and performed with the Honolulu Symphony, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the Alaska Festival Orchestra. Join us now for University Forum and Fred Ormond.
Thank you. We would like to begin this morning with a short piece of music. I feel a little more comfortable making music than I do speaking, so I think it's more appropriate that I start that way. Thank you. Thank you. Indeed, it's a pleasure to be here this morning. That simplistic little solo is one that you might have heard in any number of Texas high schools back in what I tell my students are the dark ages. And it has a story with it. A young boy played that for the first time, and his teacher recorded that performance. And that led to a journey for that young man. With that recording and that hearing of that piece of music, he fell in love with music and the idea of performance. And he went on to win two competitions that year with that solo. And the interesting thing about it was that there were students playing in the competitions that played much harder and much more difficult solos. But something about the performance moved the judges, and they gave him medals for this. The following year, that same young man became the first chair in the Texas All-State Band when he was a sophomore in high school. And he followed that by two more years of winning first chair in that band. As you might guess, that young man was myself. And I'm not saying that to brag. Well, maybe I am. But more to tell you about the teacher that was responsible for that. He was a man by the name of Chief Davidson. And not only did he have me as the first chair in the Texas All-State Band for 3 years. The two prior years, his students had won that chair, so it was 5 years consecutively that our high school held that chair. This is a feat that has not been equaled before that or since. And Chief Davidson was a very remarkable teacher. He had studied in Chicago with the principal clarinet of the Chicago Symphony, and had played in the theaters there in Chicago for several years, and in the course of playing in those theaters, became quite a fine clarinetist. He could pick up the clarinet and transpose anything. And when the theaters closed, he finally decided that he would go back to Texas and he would direct high school bands. And he was very successful at that. The high school band there won first division in sight reading, concert, and marching for over 25 years. And he was a very special person. He was a very special person to me. And as I was thinking about things to talk about today, I ran across a statement that sort of triggered some ideas. Often musicians see the statement, if you can, you play. If you can't, you teach. If you can't teach, you become a musicologist. If you can't become a musicologist, become a conductor. No, I'm just kidding about that. That's what the orchestra players say. But recently I saw a statement that said this: if you can, you teach. If you can't teach, you do something significantly less important. And it made me think back about my roots and the teachers that I had had. And I thought today that I would just relate some of these and incidences and these experiences and what they meant to me and what I think they mean in the training of a musician. If you were to ask Chief, what did he teach me? He might have said pretty simplistically, because he often spoke in rather straightforward terms and didn't make a big deal about things. Well, I taught Fred to make a nice sound on the clarinet, taught him to play in rhythm, and I taught him how to practice. And without any of those things, I could have never performed that little solo. But he was very picky, didn't say a whole lot in lessons, but he could always tell me exactly what I needed to do, and he could always tell me how to go home and practice, and he could pick up the clarinet and show me how to practice, and that was very important in those days. And, of course, I grew to idolize this man, and he became bigger in life. If he said that I would play the clarinet better standing on my head, I would have tried it. But it was very hard to leave home and go away to college and accept another teacher. But in the course of playing in the All-State Band, I met a conductor by the name of William D. Ravelli, who was a conductor of bands at the University of Michigan, and that one thing led to another, and I ended up at the University of Michigan. From being a big fish in a little pond, I suddenly became a minnow in a great big ocean. And the experience of going to Michigan was rather remarkable, because I went from a town of 18,000 to a university of 20,000. And in those days, I thought Ann Arbor was huge. Now it's the university's twice that size, and it has changed significantly. But for a young man from Texas, going to a school like that, it was quite a remarkable experience. I had there a clarinet teacher by the name of Alberto Lucconi. Albert Lucconi, he had shortened it to when he came to the United States. He had been a clarinetist in Toscanini's orchestra that was touring the United States, and at the end of the tour decided to stay in the States. Settled in Detroit, became the principal clarinet of the Detroit Symphony for several years, and was one of the most colorful individuals I think I've ever met in my life. He was about this tall. He always dressed elegantly, and he smoked a cigar incessantly. Now, in this day of non-smoking and non-smoking buildings, I've often wondered how Lucconi would have ever survived. They told the story that when he retired from the university and vacated his office, it took a year to clear out the smell of the cigar smoke. But he was a wonderful individual, a real character. We all had stories about Lucconi. I mean, we just, all the students would have a lesson and then they would compare notes. And my favorite ones had to do with a performance of the Mozart Clarinet Quintet. Lucconi was playing with the faculty chamber quartet at the university. And to his students, he always said, "Oh, the reed will make no difference." He says, "You know, you just pick a reed out of the box, you put it on the mouthpiece, and you play the clarinet." He says, no big deal. And, of course, anybody that plays a reed instrument, the reed is a big deal. But Lucconi just told us, "Oh, no, not important." Well, the afternoon before he was to play this very important concert, one of the students went into the studio, and he couldn't find the reed that he had very carefully put away for that evening's performance. And he was frantically going through reeds, just like we did. So we realized that he was a human being, although to us he was bigger than life. He had a real love of Italian opera. And I never played this next little excerpt for him, but I cannot play this excerpt on the clarinet today or in the opera pit without thinking about Lucconi and the love of music and the singing line on the clarinet that he instilled on me. He would often, at the end of a lesson, just sit down and start playing piano and could play Italian operas from memory. He had grown up in a tradition of very strong European teaching. And I sometimes feel that our students today miss something in that tradition. It was a tradition of great discipline. He told that if he played in a lesson when he was growing up and he made a mistake, he ducked because the teacher would do that. And he said, you know, after you got hit on the head a couple of times, he said, you learned to duck. So he was never that stringent with us, but he did have a very demanding way about him, and it was only years later that I could really value what he had done for me in those years. But I'd like to play you a very brief excerpt from the opera Tosca. The clarinet plays this passage in the opera pit right before the tenor sings the same opera, sings the same aria. Clarinetist, think of this as our big moment. And when you're in the opera pit, you're not seen. And so you sort of wait for these big solo moments. And I went to a performance of Tosca recently and was sitting with a friend. And I nudged her and I said, "It's coming, it's coming." She said, "What?" "Well, the clarinet solo, of course." Thanks, Larry. As Herb and I discovered last night, we had a very good mutual friend that was a principal clarinet in the Metropolitan Opera for many years. His name was also Herb Blaman. And he used to say, "You want to play that solo so it's really hard for the tenor to have to sing it after you." Following undergraduate school, I was supposed to go to the West Point Band. I took the audition and was accepted and had all my plans made to go to West Point to play in the military band and to go to New York and study privately. And I had a freak injury in college that I didn't know about, and it caused me to flunk the physical. At the time, I was really traumatized by it and didn't know what I was going to do. It was in the fall, and most universities had already started, but I knew Keith Stein, the clarinet teacher at Michigan State University, and I called him up, and they were starting the next week because they were in the quarter system. And I ended up doing my graduate work at Michigan State with Mr. Stein. He's the author of a book called The Art of Clarinet Playing, published by Summy Burchard. And it's one of the best books on teaching that I know. He was a teacher's teacher. And Mr. Stein instilled in me the love of teaching and the art of teaching. He was a terrific psychologist, and he knew just when to push you a little bit and when to just lay back a little bit and let you do your own growing. And he had a trait that we all marveled at many times, because we would, again, the students would often compare notes as they were studying. And he would have you just going to town on something, and you would be playing all this hard repertoire and thinking, oh boy, I've really got it now. This is it. I've got it made. And at that point, all of a sudden, he would take you back to some basic fundamental trait. I cannot think of Keith Stein without thinking of just a little simple exercise that he had us do so many times. It's nothing special, but I thought I would just demonstrate to show you what I'm talking about. Just to get us to increase our tongue speed and get us to blow through the instrument. And I thought that, boy, I've got this study knocked any number of times. And then he would take me back to it and do something a little special with it. He really impressed upon me the need for basics. And I often stress to my students today that if you watch a professional athlete, they're very careful about the way they warm up for an event, the way they practice their fundamental skills, and they hone those for the trials that they have to do. If you watch an Olympic athlete, their training program is really rigorous, but it's also very carefully dealing with the basics of playing, and or the basics of whatever their athletic playing skill is. Mr. Stein probably had the greatest influence on me over the longest period of time, because I often went back to him for coaching and for a little bit of polishing up on this or a little bit of polishing up on that. But I think I am a teacher today because of the influence that this man had on me. Following his encouragement and his advice, I applied for a Fulbright scholarship and went to London to study with a man by the name of Bernard Walton. I had listed three different teachers that I would like to study with when I went over there, and I happened to get Walton as, through the luck of the draw. He was, as it turned out, the one individual of those three who was really a great teacher. And this was, a growing experience for me, because it was the first time that I had ever had the opportunity to hear one of my teachers play regularly in orchestras. And so I would have a lesson, and then many times I would go and hear him in a concert that evening. And just to hear him cope with the different orchestral passages and all the different orchestral excerpts that he did was remarkable. Had a very good friend that was the principal flute of one of the orchestras, and Alex said, you know, we had Bernard in at the last minute. He had to play Shostakovich 5 with us last night, and said he sort of scuffled a little in the rehearsals, and I had never heard him do that. But he said the performance was great. Well, I had a lesson a couple of days later, and I mentioned to Mr. Walton that I heard he had played with the LSO a couple of nights ago. He said, yes. And, you know, said, I played a symphony for the first time, I believe. He said, it was Shostakovich 5. He said, you know, I've never have played that piece before. And he had walked in, played a dress rehearsal, and then played the concert that night. And he had this complete command of the instrument that I never ceased to marvel at. And I used to say, I can't get over your technical skill on the instrument. He said, oh, I don't have any technique anymore. He said, when I was a student, I used to have technique. He said, I don't get to practice anymore. And he passed on to me an approach to playing the instrument that I value still today. He believed that making music was a part of your being as a human being, and you lived your life as you played the clarinet, and you played the clarinet as you lived your life. Well, that seems a little naive, but not really, because it's amazing how the personality of an individual comes out when they're making music. And a little passage that he often had us play is a little solo piece that I'm going to just noodle through here. But the purpose of this was to get us to produce the sound freely and easily. And it's one of those things that, one of those etudes that I can come back to and play all of my life and still benefit every time I play it. Another story that I have about him, he once did a recording session at the last minute with George Schulte, before Schulte was Sir George. As a young conductor, he was quite active in London and that year. And Schulte was doing this recording, again, it happened to be with the London Symphony Orchestra, and was expecting to find a clarinetist that he had worked with many times. And this clarinetist developed problems with his wisdom teeth and didn't want to do the recording session, so Walton was called. He went in, and this was around the first or second of, I mean, it wouldn't have been the first, but it would have been maybe the second or third of January, and I knew that he had taken a real layoff over Christmas and really hadn't practiced a lot. And he went in, and they were recording, of all things, the Miraculous Mandarin of Bartok. This has three humongous clarinet cadenzas in it that are all quite difficult. Well, Schulte was very upset that the clarinet player he expected to see was not there. And so he began to pick on Walton. And he said, would you make that passage just a little bit quicker? And would you slow down more here? And would you make a quicker diminuendo there and more accent on that note? And no matter what he asked Mr. Walton for, he could give it to him. And it made a great impression on me, because it showed the command of the instrument and the ability to take a verbal command and transform it into a musical sound. And that was a skill that he had, that he really worked with the students at being able to do. And it was a big help later to me in professional life when I was out playing with orchestras. Coming back to the United States, I went to the Interlochen Arts Academy to teach. And as I had some outstanding students who were taking auditions and playing in the orchestra, among them was a young man by the name of David Schifrin, who is now the director of the Lincoln Center Chamber Players and professor of clarinet at Yale University. and Lee Morgan, who's the co-principal clarinet in the Royal Opera in Copenhagen. And both of these young men were remarkable and great players. And I began to feel that I needed to know more about the orchestral world in the United States. And so at that time, I sought out the person that everybody picked as being absolutely the pinnacle of orchestral players, and that was Robert Marcellus, the principal clarinet in Cleveland. Well, Interlochen, Michigan's in the northern part of the state. Cleveland, of course, is down in Ohio. In those days, with low speed limits, higher speed limits, I could leave Interlochen at 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and make it to Severance Hall in Cleveland in time to hear the Friday night concert of the Cleveland Orchestra, and then take a lesson the following morning, and then drive back Saturday afternoon. And that was a rather strenuous trip, but it was well worth it to hear Marcellus play in the Cleveland Orchestra and to hear this gorgeous sound and the way that he would shape a phrase and the way he would create things in the orchestra was absolutely a lesson unto itself. And he has been a man who has been a great influence in my life, and he not only passed on to me his way of making music, but his respect for the music. And he often has been a very good counselor to me. It was a very tragic thing to me when he went blind and had to retire from the orchestra. But Marcellus was very good at teaching you the basics again, but on a much higher level, because now we were dealing with some of the orchestral repertoire that was very demanding, and he really was quite demanding about those things. But it was, to me, the sort of the finishing school. That was the point where I realized that, okay, now I have the tools at my command. I have to go out and do something with them. And from his training and the advice that he gave me, I was able to audition for the Chicago Symphony. And although it did not get the job, I was runner-up and played with the orchestra for a year. And then, of all things, I was teaching in New York State the following year and got to play extra with the Cleveland Orchestra. And it was a very touching moment for me when he called me and said, you know, I saw you on TV last week. I happened to be in Cleveland, and they broadcast the concert that you were playing in. And he said, I was just really moved to see you sitting in the Cleveland Orchestra playing. So it was a special, very special payback to me that I could do that. I ended up playing 22 summers in the orchestra at the Grand Teton Music Festival. And through these experiences, I always had the desire to make music. But after several years, I realized that we're all put on this earth for a reason. And the reason for me, I think, was to teach. And although I always enjoy performing, I always seek out ways of making music and playing, to pass this on and to see young people, like many of the people sitting here today, grow and benefit from music, I think is special. These five teachers all gave me individual things. They all gave me individual characteristics. But the characteristics that they passed on, and they were so free in their giving of these, are the things that I try to pass on to my students today. And I think teaching is a challenge. I really believe that when somebody said, when you can, you teach, and when you can't teach, you do something significantly less important. Because I think the teaching of young people today is the thing that is so valuable. I cannot emphasize it enough. Value your teachers. Pick their brains. I like it when my students come in and say, you know, I heard you do this. How do you do that? And they come and they seek out what you know. And a lot of times a teacher may not realize that they are doing a particular thing or doing a particular way of playing. And the students notice it, and they come and say, you know, you did so-and-so. Well, that's a valuable thing. And as students, I challenge you to seek out your teachers, to figure out what they have to offer you, and then to take that advice. A lot of times students challenge you on advice and say, well, you know, I don't think that. I often find that my older students come to me thinking, well, I'm going to convince him how to play the clarinet. And I tend to look at it the other way around. I'm there to teach them how to play the clarinet. So I pass those along not in any way to challenge you, but to, in a way, challenge you to think about teaching. It's a valued skill. It's something that plays a great part in your life. And the days that you have here are days that will be remembered the rest of your life. I look back on my days of study with great fondness. I'd like to close now with two movements from the Poulenc Sonata. And as I said, there will be a question and answer session following. These are the second and third movement of the sonata. This was a piece that I played in London in 1963, I think it was. I gave probably the second or third performance that was done in England of this piece. It was originally written and first played in the United States by Benny Goodman and Leonard Bernstein playing piano. Poulenc wrote this at the very end of his life. There's a funny thing about clarinet compositions. The Mozart Concerto, the two Brahms sonatas, the Poulenc Sonata, the Saint-Saëns Sonata, the Martinu Sonatina, and I can go on, are pieces that composers wrote for the clarinet right before they died. I don't know why this is. I haven't quite figured out the connection, but it does exist.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Fred Ormond, professor of clarinet at the University of Michigan School of Music. His lecture was entitled Clarinet Alone. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.